This is going to be fun.
Log Talk Radio.
Let's get lost in a better place. Pick up a bird, travel through time and space. So much to learn, so much to see. A chance to escape reality. Open your mind and your heart. Gain new knowledge, get a fresh new start. They never will bring you there. So let's talk about it when life and on the
air. Hi everyone, good morning. This is Fran Lewis. I'm your host. This is MJ Network. And today's show is going to be really fantastic. We have four of the most fantastic authors in the universe here. And we're going to talk about something different. We have Alan Topol, Jim Nesbitt, T.J. O'Connor, and Dennis Palumbo. We've got the greatest cast. Oh, fantastic. We're going to talk about how they use their real-life occupations, which are all different and really exciting, in writing their novels. And it's beautiful and freezing outside and up here. And good morning, everybody. Thank you so much for doing this.
Good morning, Fran.
Good morning, Fran.
Right. I'm so glad everybody's here. So, general question for everybody. Creating plots that relate to your real-life experiences. Alan is a lawyer. TJ is a consultant in a lot of things. Dennis is a psychotherapist, and Jim is a journalist. And I read all of your bios, and Jim, I read some of your interviews. I did some research yesterday, so I get to know stuff better. Yeah. So when you're creating your plot, how do you use your real-life job to in your novels, because all of you do, and how do you incorporate these, bringing the life for readers that they're going to want to read it? Of course, they want to read everything you guys write. So how do you do that?
Well, in my case, back in my journalism days, I spent a lot of time knocking around the Texas-Mexican border, and you know, all three of my novels were shot through with the people I ran into in those places. Mm. The things I saw, you know, I really got the deep appreciation for kind of the harsh beauty of West Texas and northern Mexico. It's kind of a sunblasted region, but it's mountains are very stark. It kind of looks like the bones of the earth are ripped open for you to see. So that was quite natural for me to kind of draw on those remembrances of landscape and people. And I'm always fascinated by the interplay between the land and the people who are trying to wrest a living from it, and how they influence each other. So that was one way that I used my experience professionally to forward my books. I think another way is you run into cops, lawyers, criminals, murderers, in the course of a long journalism career, and you draw on that experience and for character sketches and character composites, and you remember shards of dialogue that you can repurpose, and it's just you just draw on what you've experienced in life, and then you build on that.
That is interesting. I'm going to ask a follow-up question in just a minute. Dennis, how do you use your psychotherapy? I mean, he's Rinaldi reminds me of a psychotherapist. So how do you use that in your
my
book?
Lead character in your Rinaldi novels is a therapist, as am I. And, I've been in private practice for 30 years as a therapist. Mm-hmm. And some of that work included working at a psychiatric hospital, so I have a lot of experience with people diagnosed with schizophrenia and other bipolar and other things. How I use it is experience, first of all, as a therapist, and since my books are in first person, I think what's unique is that the reader gets a behind-the-curtain look at what goes on in the mind of a therapist. And second, because Daniel Rinaldi works for the police, he is a trauma expert, and his specialty is treating the victims of crime. I did a lot of research on trauma and spent 5 years working with Bob Stallaro, one of the nation's number one trauma experts. So what I think what makes my book then jump out is how the reader experiences the trauma that crime victims go through and how the health profession works and doesn't work. You know, one of the opportunities I get is to look at, you know, the state of the nation's mental health and how psychology is dealt with by the police, because they have a very uneasy relationship with psychological consultants. And so that work that I've done with my patients infuses all of my books. And secondly, in terms of personal experience, a little bit similar to what Jim was saying, is I come from Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania. It's my hometown. And as many of you may know, it's undergone a renaissance. I mean, when I was a kid, it was the skies were dark with smoke, and it was all steel mills and industry. And now it's kind of a white-collar town. And so my books take place in present-day Pittsburgh. But my hero, like me, was born in the blue-collar Pittsburgh of the past. So, like me, he was the first in his family to go to college, and he has this uneasy relationship, like he has one foot in the old Pittsburgh. I mean, hell, I used to work when I was in college at those very steel mills that are now gone. And, you know, one foot in the past and one foot in the present, very gentrified Pittsburgh. So Pittsburgh's a character, and the world of clinical psychology is a character that infuses all of my books.
Yeah, that is so interesting. But there are different levels of trauma too, right? Different degrees, different things, yeah, you know, different ways, right?
The very different levels of trauma. The average person can go from, you know, who reads my books will relate, because some people just have the trauma of a breakup or a divorce or the loss of a family member, all the way up to people, because these are crime thrillers, who have been kidnapped or carjacked or raped or had a home invasion. But the PTSD symptoms, I mean, we have people having PTSD symptoms because of the fires, because of terrorism, because of homegrown mass shooting. You know, Bob Stoller says we live in an age of trauma. Because of the media, we're aware constantly of bad stuff happening all over the place every second. And so as a result, people are kind of traumatized. And so one of the things that I do in my books also is I look at what's going on in the world. For example, in my novel Night Terrors, that comes from the fact that what used to be a pediatric diagnosis, night terrors, is now being diagnosed in adults because of the amount of anxiety we all walk around with.
Yeah.
Struck me instantly as, oh my gosh, now adults are getting night terrors? And so those kinds of issues jump out at me and are woven into the quality, you know, the work that I do in my novels.
TJ, how do you use your international security consultant? Then Alan's going to tell me how he uses the law, because I looked up everybody. And you're interesting because you're doing anti-terrorism and investigations and threat analysis. So how does that go into your novels that I can't wait for the next one, please?
Well, carefully, you know, starting out, you know, and listening to Dennis and Jim, I wish mine could be as open as some of the things that they can talk about. So I've been in the anti-terrorism business since I was a young man, and I won't tell you how many years ago that was. But it's to some degree, it's a little bit like Jim mentioned, right? So, you know, you sort of go through work and life and profession, and you start gathering information, whether you know it or not, about people and places. And I've had the very big fortune of having worked with some real true professionals, you know, the unsung, if you will, in the intelligence community and counterintelligence community. So there's a lot of great folks out there that I've had the pleasure of working with. And I've also met some real dirtbags and gone up against some real dirtbags and bad people. So, you know, I sort of have to be very careful, because some of the people in my profession will look at something and go, hey, you shouldn't be talking about that. And, hey, I know who you're talking about with this character. So I sort of have to do the Frankenstein thing, right? So I'll roll in a couple of people I've worked with to create a really great positive character. I'll roll in some people that I would have liked to have driven off a bridge when I worked with them, and make them secondary characters. And then for the bad guys, that's really easy. I mean, in these days, you don't even really have to do a tremendous amount of personal research like I still do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, every day there's stuff out there in the papers, and it's easy to get access to stuff. So creating bad guy characters and nemesis characters is really easy. The difference is that I can sort of go back to events and sort of operations that I've run and pull out the things that I thought made the enemy and my colleagues very unique. And as I can sort of glue them together in a Frankenstein paste and create sort of a new character, that gives me a little bit of realism, but it also sort of insulates me against anybody thinking I'm talking about information I shouldn't, because I do have to be careful with that. And in today's age,
do you have to ask for permission to write the book? Because I know that
no,
the
I don't.
Authors
been,
that I have,
been,
you don't have to get permission from to write the book or write the information.
No, I don't at this stage. I've been technically out of the operational side for several years. I'm now a consultant, and the work that I do is relatively passive compared to the old days. But I still have an obligation, you know, to be careful, as I'm sure the other folks, you know, these guys will tell you. You know, you can talk about certain things, but there's a line you have to draw where you don't go too far. And in my case, with the book, The Consultant, that's out, it is about the building of a terrorist event coming to a small town into the Washington, D.C. area. And I had to be very careful because my first draft had a few too many details in it. And I didn't, I honestly didn't think it did. And it had some characters that you could literally look at the newspaper and say, wow, it's like this guy. And I had a couple of my colleagues read it, and they gave me some really great suggestions to say, hey, you know, don't give away the farm because you don't want this to become a playbook for the next attack. So I'm lucky that those people are close by, and I can take the people in my profession and work with them. And, you know, that's sort of the upside of still having a hand in the anti-terrorism business.
Yeah, I understand that because I've been reading a lot of books on that with terrorism, and sometimes I really feel that sometimes they write such an outline of what happens that, and then it happens. Sometimes it is a playbook for what's going to happen. That's a scary.
Well, you got to be careful, you know, and you also don't just want to get that stigma that you're telling secrets out of school, because that's something that you really don't want.
Alan, how do you use that in your Craig Cage or your Kelly Cameron, which I love? How do you use your as a lawyer? You do so many things as a lawyer.
Me as a lawyer, because I've been the same time in writing novels, I've been a partner at a large Washington law firm, and for my first 12 novels, I didn't want to have anything to do with lawyers or writing legal novels. I stayed away from it. I thought, hey, this is what I do by day, and I do not want to spend my free time and whatever writing about what I'm doing all day long, forget it. And so what happened was I was very interested in international intrigue and suspense. Living in Washington, I knew a lot of people in the intelligence community. I started to pick up information. I did a huge amount of reading. And then I started to do novels. And so my heroes, like Craig Page, somebody said those were my fantasy characters. That was my other life, the life that probably I wanted to have as opposed to being a lawyer with their exploits. However, at about after 12 novels, I decided, all right, that's it. I'm going to take a crack at a lawyer novel. And I did the book The Washington Lawyer, as you're aware of, sort of melding together the international intrigue with the lawyer thing, and made him a powerful Washington lawyer who has a chance to be Chief Justice of the Supreme Court. So I waded into the legal business, not a courtroom drama, but about the legal business. And that went and worked very, very well. So then I moved up on my newest novel, The Washington Operator, where the villain of the book is a very powerful Washington lobbyist, greedy, venal, and that's a space I've been working in my legal business. So the answer is I've come around to it on two books, and it's kind of fun. I got a lot of things off my chest about the legal profession, and now I'm going to go back and I'm going to write The French Revenge, which is absent any of this legal stuff, and I don't know where I'm going after that, Fran. But anyhow, so it's been not that I dislike the lawyering, and I love it. It's been a great career for me, and I really do. But it's just that, hey, I want to do something else when I've been writing my novels, except for these two diversions. So I know that's sort of a bizarre answer. And by the way, I grew up in Pittsburgh, Pennsylvania also, and I went High School. So where did you go to high school?
I went to Penn Hills High and then Churchill High School.
Okay, so I went to Peabody, and then I got a degree from Carnegie Tech in those days, so I know the space very, very...
Yeah, my dad went to Peabody High School.
Okay,
and
there you go.
Yeah, and I went to Pitt. I graduated from Pitt. So, I do want to make a quick comment about something TJ said about you don't want to write the playbook.
Mm-hmm.
I just saw a trailer for a horror movie coming out called Killer Therapy, about a disturbed patient who feels he's been failed by his therapist, and it's about going around killing them. And I said to myself, holy shit, I hope this doesn't give patients an idea.
sorry, but you can't watch Saturday morning cartoons and not get an idea.
Yeah, but it's like, oh, no. Here's the playbook on how to get back to all of us at all of us clinicians. Kind of scary.
I love it.
That's scary, but that leads me to my next question for everybody. See, you're helping me out here, and I'm writing notes as I'm doing this. So when you have a character in a series or just something that keeps going like Dennis does and Jim does and everybody does, how do you create a plot line that's different? How do you create the different issues? Because all I'm reading about is terrorist attacks, and it gets to me after a while. I don't want to read them anymore. So if I get something on the opiate crisis or alcohol or anxiety or homeless or something, it's different. How do you decide on your plot line that changes in every single novel? And I know, Jim, would you explain hard-boiled fiction, please? Because I did read your interview. Seriously.
Yeah, it's kind of the style that Dashiell Hammett and Raymond Chandler, among others,
mm-hmm.
developed in the 30s and 40s, almost as a counter to the English cozy novels that were predominant of the time. And they're very rooted in realism. They tend to be frank about violence, and to the degree they could get away with it, sex. They tend to focus on realistic scenarios and realistic detective work, rather than the amateur with the using deductive logic to magically come up with the killer's name while sipping tea in the parlor. So
mm-hmm.
I think it's a very American art form. I mean, it's can use hard-boiled or noir or just about any genre to
mm-hmm.
comment about anything in society, anything personal experiences. The ever dicey relationship between men and women, music, politics,
mm-hmm.
So it's to me, it's a marvelously flexible genre.
It's different. Your books are different. It's about if I have to thank Cheryl for sending it to me, seriously. And you could thank somebody for sending me too, because there are two people that are reading it as we speak, seriously.
I appreciate the support.
Yeah, well, any one of you, all I have to do is say I'm reading something by one of the, when am I getting it? I have a bad book for today for somebody else. So how do you create your plot line, Dennis or Alan or TJ? How do you do it? How do you decide where your character is going to go?
Oh, it's Alan, Fran. Let me tell you, this is where I'm sort of blessed, because I forget those two lawyer novels. I've been writing books about international intrigue and suspense, and
mm-hmm.
so my plot lines are drawn to some extent from the headlines, as they say, Saudi Arabian oil, Chinese efforts to expand into the Middle East, or U.S.-China relations, or Italian political affairs. So I sort of start with a geopolitical topic and then put my Craig Page and Elizabeth Crowder into that and build it from there. So, hey, as long as there are new international developments and trouble going on in the world, I can always come up with a new plot. So I have that advantage anyhow.
Well, the way it works, this is Dennis, the way it works for me is I always use Henry James Maxim that, you know, plot is character under stress. And so I tend to think there's a psychological issue, like the Night Terrors one I mentioned, or my novel Phantom Limb, which is about when I have a soldier who lost a limb in Iraq, but he still feels it. And I use it as a metaphor for people we've lost in our lives, and yet we still feel their presence. And so, latest novel, Head Wounds, I deal with a really fascinating psychological condition called erotomania, which is a condition where someone believes else is in love with him, and nothing that the object of that affection can say or do, up to and including getting restraining orders, can keep that person away. Once I have read something or had some experience when I worked at the psych hospital that leads me to a character, whether in Head Wounds, the character that has this condition is the bad guy. In my earlier novels, it's a victim. But I build the stories out from that character, and then how my character, who is himself damaged, as you know from my book, and Rinaldi lost his wife in a mugging, and he survived. Yeah. One of the reasons he does what he does is because he has survival guilt. He feels he's on a mission to support anyone who's been victimized by violence. And once I put him together with some character struggling with a psychological issue, the plot just spins itself out. So that's where I'm less inclined to I don't do anything like internationalism or terrorism stuff. I'm pretty much a good kidnapping or a domestic murder, and I'm off and running.
Well, your last novel scared the daylights out of me, let me tell you. That was really scary.
You know, on PBS, and the first thing the interviewer said after he read Head Wounds, he said, Dennis, are you okay?
I was like, oh my God, where did you get this guy from? Oh my God, yeah. And I was wondering, seriously, are you bringing him back by any chance?
Well, where he comes from, to be honest, is my fear of technology. You know, he is Sebastian Maddox, my villain. By the way, as you also know, it's the only novel I've written to tell the reader right up front who the bad guy is. Normally, we don't
know.
But
I know.
What? So afraid of, like, when I heard that the director of the CIA puts duct tape over the little laptop because it can be automatically and from a distance turned on. So that's what I did with Sebastian Maddox, is he knows how to do all that stuff. So invasive and terrifying. And so I just used my own paranoia about technology, which is fairly
You're not paranoid if it's correct.
Oh, yeah, that's true, you know, and it's funny, I forget who one of the reviewers said, if it does nothing else, it'll make you check all your passwords and security systems in your house and on your computer.
Oh, my God. TJ, what are you going to do next, and how do you draw, what are you going to do for Jonathan next, and how are you going to draw, what kind of a plot do you have planned for me? I can't wait already.
Well, so Jonathan is on a temporary hold. My agent had me write another novel. No, he's not gone. He's just on temporary hold. So, but I take a different sort of approach, what I try to do is I try to take a very large issue. In my case, I do a lot of things with terrorism and international threats, but I try to bring it down to the personal and the local level. So I live in a very small historic town in western, in Virginia, but in western Virginia. In Winchester, and so with the consultant, I tried to bring the evasiveness of international intrigue and stick it into a small town like Winchester, and sort of talk about what happens to the small town when these things start to percolate. And at the same time, Jonathan Hunter, who's sort of a fly-by-the-seat-of-his-pants consultant with the government, he has a personal tragedy in the opening of the book. His brother's killed, and he goes on a tear trying to find the killer, and then why these events took place. And he finds out it's about this percolating terrorist event. But in the case of the book, while it's about terrorism, it's really sort of about what happens to Hunter when he realizes that after 25 years fighting terrorism overseas in the Middle East and other places, it's really back in his hometown of Winchester. So it's the oh my God moment that he's been away, he's lost his family, and all the time what he's really been fighting is back at home. And then at the home level, it's about what happens in Winchester when refugees and terrorism and threats start to percolate around them. So I like the international flavors. I like the big events, but I really try to make it on a personal level. But to the second part of your question, I've just finished, and it's with my editor, and we're going back and forth on edits right now, a different book for me. It's got two female leads in it.
Nice.
One of the leads is a Cuban assassin on her way into the United States to carry out a nefarious act. And the other is sort of the strange sort of hero, if you will, in that she's a former Colombian a missionary that went into Colombia. She became involved with the FARC, and she's trying to escape that life back home in New York, and how the two of these people end up coming together, pro and con, against each other, but then at the end, how this affects this international crisis between Cuba and the United States. But it brings it back to the personal level of these two women who have had major crises in their life that forced them into lives they didn't want, and then what that does as they sort of rocket toward Washington, D.C., and the question is who's going to get there first and whose past life will influence the outcome of the story. So it's kind of a departure from my normal, but it still comes back to the big international crisis, but on a very personal level. And that's sort of how I approach most of my work.
That's interesting. Now that leads me to another question that Jim brought up, and Dennis and everybody. How does setting foster where the novel's taking place? And Alan, he keeps me busy. I learn a lot about historical novels, and I learn a bit about history, and learn a lot about everything when I read Alan's novels, because they take place everywhere. So how do you decide where this novel is going to take place, or do you keep it in one location? And how does it, you know, bring interest to it? How does it change each time so that somebody like myself is going to say, okay, I got your novel, I can't put it down, which, by the way, I just got David Putnam's new one that's coming out in February. I'm almost done with it. The plot list is fantastic. Bruno Johnson, I can't put it down. So that's for David. So how do you use setting and where it takes place? And Dennis, I love writing. I write in the first person because I can't stand writing dialogue. It's great. So how do you use the setting in first person or in your novels in order to keep the reader interested, especially where you decide to have the novel?
I think setting in a, you need to create a keen sense of place, and it ought to be so strong and keen that it's almost a character unto itself. Like I said earlier, I've always been interested in how the interplay between the land and the people that live on it. And, you know, when I was looking to write three hard-boiled tales of revenge and redemption, I thought, what better place to put it than, you know, a place that kind of looks like hell on earth, West Texas. So, but I think that if you don't create that keen sense of place, you're missing an opportunity to show your characters, you know, and reveal something about them without telling people. And just like snappy dialogue between characters or internal dialogue helps define a character, action as well, I think a keen sense of place does that as well. And if you don't do that, you're missing, you know, you're missing a chance to, you know, to show rather than tell.
Yeah, I couldn't agree more. I mean, I've always thought that Pittsburgh, where my Rinaldi novels are set, is a character in the story for two reasons. Number one, it's has such a rich history, and my hero's life is so embedded in the life of the city. But secondly, because, as I've mentioned before, it's undergoing such a transformation from the town that most people think Pittsburgh is to this newly gentrified town, which has not gone over so well with people who've lived there for five generations because they've been supplanted, they've been displaced, old neighborhoods have been changed and now, you know, have these very fancy lofts and boutiques and stuff. And so on the one hand, it's exciting because it's revitalized the city, but it, on the other hand, a lot of the traditional stuff is gone, and yet there's this uneasy relationship. I mean, you'll see some new glass and steel tower in Pittsburgh, and by the way, the steel used to come from Pittsburgh, now from Japan, and you'll see this new building, and then two blocks over are the cobblestone streets and the inlaid streetcar tracks for when streetcars used to run. They both exist. Very interesting. And, I, again, like I said, my lead character, the context of his life, is a foot in the blue-collar Pittsburgh of his childhood and the white-collar world that he inhabits now.
That's interesting. Alan, how do you choose your settings?
Yeah, I was influenced by my very first editor, Howard Cady, a very, very famous editor in the business at Morrow at the time, and I was writing interested in international locales, and Howard said, that's terrific because if people have been to the place you're writing about, they'll like reading about it, it'll like take them back to their trip, and if they haven't, then it's something they could look forward to. So I travel a lot, and sometimes for research, but sometimes it works the other way, is I'll go to a place just for a trip for a vacation or for traveling. Mm. For example, Argentina, the first time I went, I didn't have in mind at all to write a novel about Argentina, but I got so fascinated by the place and by what I saw that I got home and began drafting out a novel, and then I went back, and that book became The Argentine Triangle. So I really like the different international locales, and I've been to all of them, as you know, Fran, and to try to make them interesting for the reader to want to know about the place, visit the place, or, you know, see the place. And so I think that's pretty fascinating. And then I'll go and research. Other times it's, I know, hey, I want to put some parts of the novel here, the island of Ischia, for example, in the Washington Operator in Italy. And so I'll go there and do research. And, you know, and you find interesting things. And just to drop a footnote to what my colleague said a minute ago about Pittsburgh and the streetcar tracks, I want you to know I just came back from Milan. I was in Milan, Italy, 3 weeks ago doing research for a new book, and I want you to know that the streetcar is still alive and well in the city of Milan and operating as it did in Pittsburgh when we grew up. So anyhow, you do see things when you travel.
TJ, how do you decide on where John or where your characters are going to be? I mean, this is a different book, this new one, New York, Cuba. That's amazing. So how did you decide on where this is going to take place? And when Alan and Dennis, every time you do something, I could actually close my eyes and feel like I'm there. Seriously.
Well, thank you, Fran. That makes me feel good. I'm glad to hear it, though. I have to tell you, when I get calls or emails from my fans in Pittsburgh, they never talk about character or plot. All they go is like, well, hey, you have them making a left turn on South Street during traffic. No one can do that. I want an email from a city planner who said, look, I like your books, but the way you have Daniel Rinaldi come home from his office in Oakland to his house in Mount Washington is all wrong, and here's how he should do it. So she gave me the schematic of how my hero should get home in traffic. And I use that from now on, and I even gave her an acknowledgement in the fourth book.
Yeah, that reveals the risk of you know, using detail. I mean, you got to get it right because there's somebody out there who will call your hand if you don't get it right, and that may spoil the whole book for who knows how many readers. So, you know, you got to get the detail right. You know, sure, it gives you authenticity and the like, but if you get it wrong, it really can torpedo your book.
Yeah, I know.
I don't know. My experience is readers kind of delight in catching you sometimes.
They live for it.
But I understand. I mean, I try to be as accurate as I can about Pittsburgh, though I live in Los Angeles, and I use Google Maps and my friends back east, you know. Now I'm so afraid, I'll call up a friend and go, look, I have it at the Penn Hotel. Is it still there? And they go, oh, no, they knocked it down last year.
Yeah.
You know, so now
yeah.
I check every location to make sure it still exists.
Oh, God. Well, TJ, how do you decide where it's going to take place, and how did you decide in this new book?
Well, it sort of decided for me. You know, like the other guys, I travel a lot, and I spend a considerable amount of time up in Manhattan for business. And in that case, I was sitting there in a cafe one day and sort of watching people and you know, getting ready for a big meeting I was going into, and I realized that the setting was an excellent location for a big event. And then as I started to, you know, do my work, and I won't go into what that was, I started realizing that as much time as I spent up there, it was a great place to launch a book. One, because of the multicultural aspects of the area. Two, because, you know, short of literally conducting a huge attack or a killing in downtown, you can get away with a lot of stuff in front of people, and they just don't pay any attention to it. You know, it's just sort of normal when you're in parts of New York. So it started there, and it sort of permeated out. Part of the book also takes place down in Nuevo Laredo in Mexico. And I had the pleasure or displeasure, I'm not sure which one it was, years ago to be down there on some work. And the dichotomy between Laredo and Nuevo Laredo was stark in some places, and other places there shouldn't have even been a border. So I started looking at, again, the small town aspect, then there's the big city aspect of Manhattan. But so with the consultant, I used setting, and I can't remember whether it was which of the other guys it was that said that, you know, setting oftentimes takes on a characterization of itself and becomes a character, and I think that's really true, because in my case, putting a huge thing like a terrorist event into a small town like Winchester really casts a whole different feeling for what people think about terrorism and about the impact of it. In my case, it's what happens to a small town, because people often say all politics are local. Well, I've got bad news for my colleagues in Washington, but terrorism is local. It affects the individual, it affects families, it affects small towns, it affects everybody differently. But when you put it in a small town like Winchester, where it's not as multicultural as other places, there's a lot of contrast that comes out, and there's a lot of bad side of people that come out. And that's sort of what made me stay here, was I wanted to bring out that impact of what happens to the townspeople when this event begins, and what happens when they find out that, you know, the lead character has been overseas involved in this stuff, and what do they think about him? Going forward go ahead.
I can't wait for the new book. No, as a matter of fact, I have to pick up on something that you said, because you're right. People walk in the street in New York. I go to the Thriller Fest, and sometimes I just take a walk around, and I look around, they're looking on their cell phone, they're talking. Nobody's talking to anybody. Nobody's paying attention. You see homeless people on the street. You see different people. I mean, there's people everywhere. And then I walk into the hotel, and I'm saying, like, oh, my God, I know there's security, but where is it? And there are thousands of people in the hotel, and nobody's watching anything, and nobody's walking. I put my cell phone in my pocket. It's amazing to watch people. I mean, how would that happen if you're actually walking in the street in New York, and out of nowhere, they use a cell phone to do something? That's scary.
Well, you know, DHS has that byline, see something, say something. Well, that's really good if people would look up and see something. But at the end of the day, it's not, you know, it's just human nature. And now when you go into a busy city like New York or even L.A. or anywhere else, people before technology were consumed by, you know, their own daily lives and didn't pay a lot of attention. There's a lot of coldness to what goes on out there. But add in the cell phones and all the other stuff, and it's incredible what can go on right in front of you. I sat in a cafe and watched, you know, a fist fight, a robbery, you know, a screaming car chase, And you know, I'm sitting here talking to a colleague of mine in the let's just say the business community and with the government, and he was immune to it. He lived in Manhattan, he worked there, and he was sort of immune to it. And I'm like, you know, I haven't been out of this business that long, but did you notice X, Y, and Z? And he said, oh yeah, that goes on all the time. So that's
sort of
why I picked that area in Manhattan, in Brooklyn, and those areas.
Actually, sometimes when I go to the Thriller Fest, I said, like, do I really want to go there? What's going to happen? It's a lot of fun, though. The hotel is really great, but you begin to wonder who are all these people that are in there. So my next question is, what issue or what topic have you never used in any of your novels would you like to incorporate, something different other than what's happening? If you could pick out a different topic in the news, anything, like alcohol issues with your characters, well, Dennis can come up with anything, which is great. Anxiety, the homeless, gambling addiction. What would happen if you wrote a novel and got rid of all cell phones and communication and everything was knocked down? I mean, what would you like to incorporate that you've never incorporated in any one of your novels? I just thought of that.
Well, you just answered the question I get asked, why do I set my novels in the 80s and 90s? And it's one of the big reasons is I don't want technology to dominate the book. I'd like to tell a cleaner, you know, simpler story. And I can remember reading one of the late, great James Crumley's latter works, and it seemed like every couple of seconds he's flipping open a cell phone. Now, I realize that's how we live today, but it really kind of got in the way of the story. I'm sidestepping and probably doing it in not the bravest manner, but by setting them back before cell phones took over and laptops and tablets came along, I'm avoiding it.
I know.
Yeah,
it's
I find
that's amazing.
And
what about you?
Well, GPS and cell phones, all those things are a huge pain. And so if somebody's kidnapped or you have to make sure there's no cell tower near them, or they took the SIM card out of their phone. Again, given my feeling about technology, you know, if someone could be one with nature, I'm like two with technology. stuff. But every time my first draft, I always have someone read it and go, yeah, but they could have just checked, you know, followed them on their GPS, or they could have tracked them. Like, oh, all right. So I have to always deal with that, which is such a huge pain. But to answer your question, I've dealt with, you know, gambling, addiction, alcoholism.
Yeah.
What I have not dealt with is the homeless. And I think about as maybe something that needs to be worked into the next book.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, RG's book, Below the Fold, deals with a murder of a homeless, well, he's supposedly a homeless. It's phenomenal. And I find that we need to make that more prominent, because a lot of people are not doing anything and they don't realize what happens to these people and why they're so homeless. And as a matter of fact, I had read a book once in a long time ago where the people lived on the street because they lived in their car because they didn't have a social security number or an address, and it took forever in order for them to get it. So that's an important issue that bothers me also, and alcoholism and kids too. What do you think?
Okay, but wait a second. I'm still back on the technology thing. I don't want to sound like the Washington person on this call, but sometimes we work hard to be accurate, you know, and on our technology. But sometimes our books are more accurate than the real world. Instead of suppose any one of us wrote a draft of a novel. I don't mean to sidetrack us into politics, but suppose we wrote a novel. And we had a U.S. ambassador in Kiev at a restaurant, and he took out his cell phone at that restaurant in Kiev, and he called the president of the United States and to discuss a sensitive security issue. And any of us submitted that draft novel to our editor, the editor would knock it out and say, wait a minute, people, don't you know you can't use a cell phone? Of course it's going to be tracked by the Russians. So, my God, are we more realistic than the real world? Is that what's going on now? I mean, it is a fascinating thing with technology, really.
So why do politicians have some – politicians that shouldn't have cell phones have them and use
right.
them all the time? And they shouldn't.
Yeah.
Basically,
why
do really.
They do anything?
Right. I mean, so, you know, in a sense, we worry about making it real accurate, but the real world isn't perhaps mm-hmm. as accurate as we're trying to make it. I don't know.
Yeah, I understand what you're saying, because in a funny way, every time there's mm-hmm. some story about some politician's leaked emails
yeah.
and stuff, part of me goes, well, didn't they assume that this is not deleted, really, even if you press delete?
Right.
I know
that's
nothing
right.
about technology, but I assume anything I type into my little laptop is fair game for everybody. That's why I never
correct.
Talk about personal or important.
Right.
So when
right.
I find
you,
a level guy has, you know, been sexting his mistress, what is he, crazy? I don't understand.
Right.
I know, even your emails, your text messages, everything. Even if you go and
right.
search on Google, they're going to know you're there. Everybody knows you're there. You can't hide it.
Of course. Absolutely.
What we seem to be dancing around is one of my rules of the road. You know, when you deeply research something, either, you know, the downtown map of Pittsburgh or how the mountains come together and clash in the Big Bend country of Texas or whatever, you know, you always have to remember you're not writing a travel log. You're not writing, a historic piece that's tracing the history of Pittsburgh. And you have to, you know, kind of pick the details you use judiciously to, you know, drive that story forward. And if it doesn't, kill it.
Well, you think that's a very good point, because you're not writing a travelogue. And one of the ways I think
right.
I get around it is I often have my big set pieces take place in very particularized Pittsburgh things. Like Night Terrors takes place, the climax takes place in an abandoned steel mill in Braddock.
Mm.
And I have a novel that the key kidnapping money drop takes place at the Allegheny Observatory. I pick fairly iconic things that we associate with Pittsburgh. But you're absolutely right. You can't, you know, the only thing I think I overuse is writing about the Three Rivers, you know, the Allegheny and the Monongahela forming the point and then becoming the mighty Ohio. I think because I heard that 1,000 times in grade school.
It's hardwired into you.
And looking down at the point. And I don't think a novel has escaped my desk without me mentioning the Three Rivers.
This is very true. And I learned a lot about them. But before I forget, this is the last show for November, people. We're going to start again on December 3rd with Matt Coyle and Lost Tomorrows. And one of my favorite people in the whole universe, John Land, on the 5th, Time for Murder. He's bringing back Jessica Fletcher. And it's fantastic. On the 10th, Alan Topol is going to be joining us again with Charles Salzberg, Marcia Casper-Cook, and Marilyn Levinson. Talk about another topic that bothers me. How do libraries and bookstores help local authors? How does the community help authors? Because up here they don't do anything. And on the 12th, Dennis Palumbo and Reese Hirsch, Michael Embry, and John Lamb are going to be joining me. We're going to talk about the opiate crisis, because this is something that's in the news and it bothers me a lot, too. And on the 16th, Jill Rosenfeld, the last Romanoff. And on the 18th, Lou Aranio, he's a publisher, and he's going to talk about his novel, Birthright. And then we will stop until 2020. So my one final question is, what issues have not been addressed in novels? And what issues would you like to try out that you've never tried out before in a novel? Anything special? Before we talk about Dennis's new book, which is called Mirror Image, you said? Is that it? Am I right? Did I look that right?
What, my new book? No, it's called
the
Head
next
Wound.
One?
Mirror Image is the first book
no.
in the series.
I'm Head Wounds, I didn't read that one.
Yeah, Head Wounds is the most recent. The one
that
scared the heck
out
of you. Yeah, that's the
it's
most
still
recent.
Scaring me. Yes, I get nightmares. What about night terrors? Yeah, after some of these books that I read. So, what issues would you like to include? Anything original that you have never tried that you would be tempted to try in your next one? We have about 9 minutes left, I think, maybe more. Well, Jim, what are you going to try to do?
Steroid use in college students.
Uh-huh, that's good.
And the way in which college students, athletes, are not only roided up, but inducements they use against each other. Very similar to what happened to USC years ago when they found out about bribes and trades and all this stuff. There's so much money involved in college athletics. And so I'm thinking of doing something like that because I haven't seen enough about it, and it's a huge issue for people between like 18 and 22.
I agree with you. My nephew's on a scholarship in college on baseball, and I know because I text him almost every day to make sure he's okay. That I don't, you can't say whether any of the baseball players use steroids or whatever. It bothers me. That's probably why we're going to do the show on the 12th about, you know, steroids, opiates, and the first line of defense the doctor says to you after surgery is, which one would you like? And they give you like a laundry list.
Oh,
like,
I know.
You know, it's like A to B. Would you like? I can't stand that.
Yeah, I'm looking forward to that podcast because the opioid epidemic is huge and real.
Yeah. And it's using this. Anybody else have an issue that they would like to incorporate?
Yeah.
Because there's nothing that you guys are going
like
to read that I'm not going to read.
Yeah, I'd like to, Fran, I'd like to set another novel in South America the way I did the Argentine Triangle. But the trouble is my agent keeps telling me American readers are not interested in South America. They don't want to hear about it. So I think
yes,
I'm going to stick with Europe, but I don't know. Really. Anyhow.
Well, did you ever write one about Israel? Or did you ever do anyone about Israel or Japan or something like that? You did.
I wrote a couple about Israel. I wrote A Woman of Valor, which is
a
possibility of a movie. And I also wrote Spy Dance, which is very much set in Israel. So I did two of them and had a lot of fun with those, which is great. But God, I'm afraid to touch the subject now. It's just the sands are shifting too rapidly, so it's dangerous.
I wonder if
anybody
would ever write a book about Greenland or Iceland. I don't think anybody has tried that one. That would be different.
Yeah.
So.
Go ahead, Fran. I'll have a great topic for you.
What?
Yeah, but hey, Fran, I'll just drop one quick footnote because I know time's short on Iceland. So I was at a speaker's conference with this novelist from Iceland, and she said it's tricky writing novels in Iceland because how do you know how to kill people? Because there are no guns in Iceland, not at all.
Oh, my God.
So you have
that's
to come
fantastic.
Up with novel ways to kill people. Did you know that? I mean,
yeah, I know, but you can always
seriously.
Have a sharp piece of ice. You can actually take a piece of ice and make it really sharp and whatever.
Right.
Oh, my God. Jim, what are you going to write next? What's up? What's next for you?
I'm trying to I'm toying around with dragging my main character, Ed Earl Burch, out of Dallas.
I like him.
Because none of my books wind up having him spend much time there, and actually put him out in West Texas on a more permanent basis. He'll be older, and I'm toying around also with the idea of writing about a sober Ed Earl. That should be a challenge. You know, as we age, we all have to hang up the saloon spikes sooner or later. So that's one of the things that I'm toying around with.
That's interesting. That is interesting. And TJ, when are you coming out with the next one?
Well, it's tentatively titled Anna's Play, and it's it just got back late last night from my developmental editor, and we've got some ideas. We're going on a conference call to talk about. So it'll get to Kimberly, my agent, probably at the end of December or so. So at that stage, I've got to write two books this coming year, which ought to be interesting because I'm working about 75 hours a week. Kimberly was successful. My very first book contract, going back several years, was a cozy mystery series with a paranormal spin to it. And Midnight Inc. went out of business a couple years ago, and we got our rights back. And she has actually resold that series is in the process of finalizing a deal with another publisher, and they want me to write at least one more of those because they love the series. And then I'm going to be writing probably a sequel to Anna's Play. And somewhere in there in the next year to 18 months, I will be putting out, you know, another Jonathan Hunter novel.
That's good because I can't wait. I have a pile of books inside that's taller than my 5 feet. And for those of you that don't know, I'm not a great writer. I try. And Silent Voices came out in June, and it's told from the point of view of the dead person behind the gravestone that either did something wrong or somebody did something wrong to them. And actually, I'm going to attempt to write one more, I think.
Good.
I have a few people that need to be behind the gravestone because they, you know, did the wrong thing. I'm going to tell you. I try. But we'll start with Dennis. Dennis, where can we find out more about you and your work?
Well, I guess you can find out at my website, cleverly named DennisPalumbo.com. I also have an author page on Facebook, Daniel Rinaldi Mysteries. And those are the two places you can usually find out about what's going on with me, all five of the Daniel Rinaldi novels, and a bunch of articles that I have done about the topic of writing and stuff that have been, you know, published. So that's where I would go. I would go to my poor little domain website. And it's a lot of bells and whistles. It's pretty straightforward. But you know, it's a small thing, but my own, you know. And I recommend people go to that website.
Well, that is interesting. And I'm going to put out the link in a few minutes. Alan, where can we learn more about you and your work? And hi, Patrick. He's listening.
Yep, you can go to places. Go to my website, www.alantopel.com, and that'll give you the lineup. The newest book is up on Amazon, The Washington Operator. And in fact, all my books are, of course, up on Amazon and electronic and on paper, and that'd be the best and easiest way to get hold of them.
Jim, where can we learn more about you? And thank you, Cheryl, for sending Jim my way.
I thank Cheryl Daly. You can track down my website, which is jimnesbitt.com, and it's jimnesbittbooks.com, and Nesbitt is spelled with two T's. And you can also track me down on Amazon via my author page. This book, The Best Lousy Choice, I've also got up on Kobo and Barnes and Noble Nook and iBooks. So look me up and get ready for a West Texas thrill ride if you pick up any of the three.
And TJ, where can we learn more about you and your work? And who's coming to the Thriller Fest to wave at me this time? Seriously.
Well, my originality ranks right up there with the other three. I'm at tjoconnor.com. And, of course, I've got a Facebook page by the same name, and I'm up on Amazon. So I think we all three have the same secret formula that we've fallen upon. But you can learn from me right there.
That is so fantastic. I want to thank everybody. This has really been informative, let me tell you. And for those of you, I'm going to put out the link in a couple of minutes. I'm going to send everybody the link. And I can't wait to read your next book. Just make sure that I get it first so I could set up the interviews and everything, because I'm getting too popular lately. First of all, Alan, did you get the award that I sent you by any chance? I'm not sure if you saw it.
No, I have not gotten it yet, Fran. I have not. I really look forward to it.
I sent it about 3 weeks ago. So let me read it so that everybody knows it's there. Yeah, I'm going to resend it. I know I did. And I was going to announce it at the top of the show. And Alan Topel gets the 2019 award for, if I could find my own thing here, the best, here it is, Outstanding Legal Thriller for Alan Topel.
Well, congratulations.
Yeah.
Congratulations. Fabulous. Thank you. Will you send it? You're going to email it to me, Fran?
Yes, I am going to do that. I am going to email it to you.
Thank you. I'm thrilled.
Yes, you did. Because, this was hard because there were so many people, you know, as a matter of fact, I didn't know, we know where to say. And somebody, I gave Charles Salzberg, the top male author, and I got criticized for that one. I was like, excuse me? I thought I was doing something great, and I answered every person that said, how come you decided to do that? And the female author was Hallie Efron for Watch Careful What You Wish For. And I thought it was a fantastic book, because I was just trying to be nice. And they're like, how come you decided to decide between male? Because I just did, because I'm allowed to do what I want. And I was just trying to be, I mean, really, criticizing something. And this has been going on for the last 3 weeks. Like, how come you did it? Because I felt like it, you know, same thing. But I want to thank everybody. Thank you so much. I'm considering doing another panel show in February. I will let you know what the topic is. I haven't decided yet. But I think that if anybody is interested, seriously, e-cigs and vaping is important. And I think that there's a lot of things in the news about kids, you know, smoking too much and selling cigarettes and stuff like that to minors. So that's one thought that I have for February. But I want to thank everybody. Everybody, this is beautiful outside. Have a great day, everyone, and bye.
Thank you so much, Fran. Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Fran.
Pleasure being on.
Thank you. Likewise. Thank you.